crime across New York City has fallen to historic lows. Back in 1990, at the height of the crack epidemic, there were 2,262 murders. Last year, 332. But one part of the city still doesn't feel terribly secure. In the South Bronx neighborhoods of Melrose, Mott Haven, and Port Morris, police sirens and gunshots still form a near-nightly soundtrack. Their streets continue to endure some of the highest crime rates in New York City. That's why New York Times reporters Benjamin Mueller and Al Baker spent a year reporting on them. They hung with cops and criminals, residents and relatives of murder victims, and created Murder in the 4-0, a series of stories that chronicled every homicide that occurred in the city's 40th precinct.
Well, I remember sitting down around a conference table at the Times at the end of 2015, and our editor, Henri, was searching for a way to kind of tell stories of murder in New York City in a different way. We had in the past written a lot of 250 words crime stories that were not all that revealing about why the murder had happened, who had been killed. We skipped a lot of the murders that involved people with criminal histories because they were sort of less unexpected. And then at the end of the year, we would come back and write this big crime story about the year-end crime numbers, which was dense with data and not so much for readers with the kind of context of why that violence was happening, who it was hurting, where it was happening, how it was changing in very sort of local pockets of the city. And we wanted to do it a little differently. We wanted to make sure we were giving the crime that still remained in New York City its due and the people who had hurt their due.
Welcome to The Breakthrough, ProPublica's podcast on how today's investigative reporters nailed their biggest stories. That was New York Times reporter Benjamin Mueller describing the earliest stages of Murder in the 4-0, in which he and veteran Times reporter Al Baker teamed up to illuminate how law enforcement and residents grapple with crime in the South Bronx, a place that the wider public and the powerful have long neglected. Here's Al.
The narrative has been the same for many, many years. Crime has been dropping since the mid-90s and has reached a level or a plateau at this point that demands extra scrutiny on where it still is occurring, on the places in New York City where it persists. Even if those are historically low, it's valid to compare the most violent places in New York City at this moment to the rest of the city, to the experience that the rest of the city has had in coming along in a safer time. That absolutely informed us on where to look at. That was exactly the premise.
I think part of the goal was to understand more deeply how the police had driven crime down in the 4-0 and elsewhere. I mean, we were trying to get an in-depth look at what an investigation looked like and what the sort of new tools the police department were using that were being put into effect in places that were still troubled by crime and other places too. And I think the other question in our minds was, how has the police department changed in an era of lower crime? Like, that informed a lot of our thinking too. Have they poured resources into the neighborhoods where crime remains a problem or not? How has the police department as an organization and an investigative body changed at a time of historically low crime, or has it not really?
Ben and Al began seeking answers to these questions after the murder of 59-year-old Carmen Torres Gonzalez. She was killed by her neighbor, who had a history of mental illness.
It was a particularly vicious crime. It was a young man with a machete that he had hid under his bed for some weeks before he committed the killing, walked right into the hallway of his public housing project in the southern part of the precinct and killed his neighbor, essentially. Yeah, it was shocking for all of us. And the scene was quite, vivid and sort of wrenching to see. A couple days after the killing, I think 2 days later, we were going back. I was going with another reporter's vet to speak to a neighbor of this woman who had been killed, who she had, in fact, delivered some soup to the morning before she died. And the floor was still stained with the victim's blood, which was shocking to me in and of itself, that this was a public housing building and the city had not yet cleaned the blood off the floor. But as we were standing there knocking on the door of the neighbor trying to persuade her to speak with us, we heard from around the corner two friends of the victim getting out their cleaning supplies on their hands and knees to wipe down the blood. And they're distraught. I mean, they are sobbing. They are then screaming. The killer had lived in an apartment no more than 5 or 6 feet on the other side of the hallway. His door had become tagged with graffiti from I'm not sure whom, killer, and angry messages to him. The fact that these two women were, as they were grieving, were trying to clean up a public housing hallway that was shared by 15 or 20 tenants on this floor was kind of staggering to me, and it spoke to the way these people are often living the aftermath of murder in a shadow, and very few people in New York City are paying much attention in city government or the media. And these are the kinds of scenes you miss if you do the single day crime stories.
And this was a woman who was the subject of a lot of affection, right, from her neighbors, and was kind of beloved in the community. What was it like to go about speaking to people about her character and her death?
I mean, it wasn't easy. I think it, this family, like many others, was suspicious of, or kind of skeptical of how we would invest our time and energy, just as they were skeptical of how the city had invested its time and energy in keeping their loved one safe. It helped, I think, that we were working with, on that story, I remember there was a photographer, Edwin Torres, who is from that neighborhood and speaks Spanish, and it was a great help to me and to us to have him around. And I think just to keep coming back and back, and we went to her funeral, which is difficult, but it was important to us both to show our respect to the victim and to sort of see the way the people in her life are remembering her. It was just a matter of going back and back and finding relatives who the city might not have known about, who might not have been in their records, but who we were able to work up through our own research and public records searches and everything, and showing up at their doors and spending time with them and sitting down and making sure it wasn't sort of a quick turnaround interview, and to promise them in some way that the story was going to be a fuller representation of that woman's life and the things that they were angry and had questions about.
Carmen was murdered by a man named Angel Feliz Volquez. His story exemplifies a set of problems that stem from the intersection of criminal justice and mental health, the kind of systemic gap Ben and Al knew they'd find by digging deeply into each individual murder case.
He had had 911 calls or other encounters with the authorities that had landed him in a mental health institution, I think 4 times in the lead up to the death, and once he was hospitalized for a few days. And there was also an important piece of it, which is, and I think in the series as a whole, we were sort of able to look back at prosecutorial decisions that had happened long in the past with all of the advantages of hindsight and see, you know, and sometimes talk to lawyers who wouldn't have spoken in the midst of them and see into them in a way we couldn't in the moment. But he had also been prosecuted for a jarring and strange attack when he was working as a dishwasher at a restaurant in Lower Manhattan. And he had lashed out at someone and hit and struck them in the head for no reason and hurt someone quite badly. And all the victims of that attack had also told the prosecutors that it stemmed from a mental health problem, but neither his defense lawyer nor the prosecutors raised that as a concern at the time, and he was let off somewhat leniently. So I think it illustrated the challenges for prosecutorial agencies of balancing wanting to give people second chances and also recognizing who the really dangerous mentally ill people are. It's a really hard decision for them to make, but the city is sort of working in some ways on getting a better handle on the intersection of violence and mental illness, and it's certainly not the majority of mentally ill people who are violent, but it does remain one of the most stubborn causes of violence in the city.
The relationship between the NYPD and the press can be fraught, but Al and Ben, in one of their many reporting triumphs, managed to overcome the department's suspicion and skepticism and gain unique access into the 40th precinct.
They just saw just how deeply we were reporting and how carefully we were writing about their work and their devotion to solving these cases, the detectives in the 40th precinct, the level of detail that we got into in terms of the people's lives, both on the victim side and the assailant side. I mean, there were a lot of times that we would go much further than they would have a need to in closing or solving a case. In researching someone's past, as Ben said, he often went to court records and going back years, decades to piece together intricate points in people's lives that had great meaning, or tracing their pasts even back to foreign countries like Mexico. Nadia Saavedra was married in the hills of Mexico. We had someone go there, a reporter went there and talked with her family, and we had some photographs from her wedding in the paper. And the police were always remarked to me that they were struck that our ability to find out things that they wish they could learn as well or had time to understand. So I think they saw the stories as a gift in a way to them. You know, they're human beings, they're burdened, sometimes it's hard for them to look at violence because it does have such an impact on you as a human being, and they need to keep moving on.
There was one name that came up several times throughout. Sergeant Michael Lapuzzo, the head of the precinct's detective squad, obviously a key source. Can you tell us about how you garnered that relationship in particular?
Well, there was a decision made by the police department early on, actually after the first story had been published and the second murder had occurred in February of Freddy Collazo. They had been deliberating our request to have access to the squad. The sergeant couldn't give that permission alone. It had to come from the highest levels of the department. The commissioner at the time, Bratton, from what I'm told, was weighed in on the decision. They made a decision after the first story published and the second murder occurred to allow us to speak. It happened bit by bit. I mean, it was like anything. I mean, there was an opportunity to be present for the investigation. As time went on, the access to the squad became deeper and deeper. As I said, I think it's a reflection of the value in the stories and the work and their notion that this was a place that, and this was part of what fed our decision ultimately to go to the 40th Precinct, was that this wasn't a place that was written about and that the narratives weren't formed in many ways. So they were happy to have some light shone on this area of the city.
One man murdered in the 4-0 was Francisco Perez. He had a tough background, several arrests, well-known history with police. But Ben went to great lengths to talk to those closest to him. They weren't easy to find, but the work paid off. He humanized a troubled young man whose story normally wouldn't amount to much more than a grim statistic.
Yeah, his story has definitely stuck with me. I think there were a few important moments in reporting that story. The first was to understand his criminal life, his work in drug dealing. And, you know, we went back into the court files and saw some of his arrests and saw where he was arrested and started going to that corner where he had been arrested several times. And it was this one corner in the South Bronx. And we went back and back and back again. And often there was a crew of guys hanging out on the corner. And in the days after it, they were distraught. And he was not killed immediately, sadly. He was in the hospital for some time. He had been shot in the head but didn't die immediately. And so his friends were in mourning and they were visiting the hospital. And there are people who have had long histories with cops hounding them on that corner and were not eager to talk to us. But we eventually built up some knowledge through the court files and started learning about some of his friends too from the court files. And we went back enough times that one time we saw this same man who we'd encountered there a number of times, and we knew him just in passing. He had not been so happy to see us before, but he was in a slightly better mood that day. And we happened to know about him, in fact, through the court files. And we hadn't actually made the connection that he was the person we were reading about in the files. But I think he was sort of impressed that we knew all this about that he had beaten these federal charges and, you know, that he had had this somewhat colorful history on that corner. And he was impressed. And I don't know if he let us talk to him that day, but it gradually built where we were going out to lunch with him and spent whole days, seven, 8 hours with him at a time, driving into Manhattan, driving back, seeing the city together. And that was really meaningful. And the other thing, even after getting to know this man, was that we didn't really feel like we understood Francisco's family life and his childhood. And he had one cousin who I had met in the days after the murder. She was from out of town, but she was there to see him in the hospital. But she didn't want to give me her phone number and didn't want to talk to me again. And so weeks later, we were trying to find her, and we still couldn't reach her through Facebook and mail and whatever else. And so I took a long road trip to find her, where we knew from public records and from my having spoken to her that she lived, and we didn't have the exact address. There were three of this particular street name in the city I was in, and I was driving from one to the next and talking to mail people and neighbors and landlords and anyone I could, property managers, whoever, to try to find this woman who did not want to speak to me. I ended up at the home of her of a friend of hers on Facebook, because we could find a better address for her, and she was at the home we thought she was. And she called up her friend, who was obviously shocked that I was there. I mean, I hadn't given her any notice that I was coming. And I could hear her yelling through the phone at her friend, "Why is he here? Like, tell him to go away. I told him I didn't want to speak to him." And finally, our superstar research person, Susan Beachy, found this one other address that maybe someone in her family had bought recently. And I sat outside that home, and it was like 10:30 at night or something. And finally, she comes out of her home, and we speak for like 2.5 hours on her stoop. And that was what really sort of opened the door to me into understanding the cycles of death and illness and drug addiction in his family that had led him to where he ended up.
So what did she finally end up telling you after you broke down all those barriers to get her to talk?
There had been a series of deaths in his family that essentially left him and this cousin on their own at age 15 or 16 in the Bronx. They had their own apartment. She was working a job. He was trying to finish school or make it somehow. But he had lost several family members very early on, several of them to AIDS. And he was essentially on his own. And it sort of helped me understand how someone would seek a life dealing drugs, because there were few options, and he had been surrounded by tragedy from a very young age and never gotten much help, really.
Al and Ben's reporting led to significant impact. The precinct got more resources, including 4 new investigators, but there's more work to be done.
The resources are an important piece of it. We found that the Bronx as a whole was substantially understaffed compared to other parts of the city, that the outer boroughs were understaffed compared to Manhattan. That's in precinct detective squads and also in homicide squads and robbery squads. And then if you look over a long period of time, there are certain precincts in Manhattan where crime has dropped substantially that have gotten more detectives, whereas a place like the 40th precinct where crime has, overall crime, has actually barely moved and in some cases gone up over the last 15 or so years, they've had their detective ranks cut. And so it's not only a problem in the 40th precinct. And I think there are some, you know, city politicians, the council speaker and the public advocate, people who have ties to outer borough areas that have, you know, that suffer the ill effects of this kind of unbalanced resources. They've called for more transparency. They've called for the police department to say more about how they solve crimes, their clearance rates, the rate at which they make arrests on crimes, and to be more public about their staffing, which historically they've not been.
I think so much of what's going on in terms of the relationship between citizens and the police is deeper than even what the police alone as an institution can do. It's complicated. As Bratton used to say, you can't arrest your way out of a problem. And whether these new neighborhood coordinating officers, which is a sort of a rekindled community policing program, which is active in the 4-0, whether that's successful or not is yet to be seen, and how it's going to be measured and how people will find it. Those are all unanswered questions.
These guys spent a year writing about murder. Material doesn't get much more charged than that. The job could be draining, emotionally and otherwise, but the challenge of it all seemed to keep them going.
The responsibility of telling people stories that weren't otherwise going to be publicly told, I felt was sort of weighing on me all the time, that this was the chance to publicly give some account of someone's life and publicly give some account of how the government had failed them or had done something to help them.
And that's something you've said to people a lot in the interviews as well, I remember, yeah.
Yeah.
Standing at someone's doorway and sort of explaining to them why it's important to speak to us or why we feel it's important.
Yeah. And the chance we had to give the sort of personal history of someone that otherwise wouldn't have been given. And for the victims, it was when there's a police officer killed or there's a child killed or there's a sort of high-profile killing in Manhattan. In some ways, our approach is the standard response by newspapers across the city is to do a very detailed look at tracing contact between the authorities and the, you know, alleged perpetrator and giving a really sort of human picture of who the victim was. And this was our chance to give that same treatment to people who hadn't gotten it traditionally. So
what do you guys want listeners to take away from all this?
I don't know. Is this the best we can do?
You've been listening to The Breakthrough, the podcast from ProPublica where investigative reporters reveal how they nailed their biggest stories. Our producer is Kate Brown. Our engineer is Tim Kramer. Our executive producer is Celeste Lecomte. Our theme music is by Mirel and Tony. I'm Joaquin Sapien. Next week on The Breakthrough, Annie Waldman talks to Cora Currier from The Intercept about the FBI's quiet expansion of power since 9/11.